This Israel Report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, good morning. Hope you're well.
Boker Tov. I'd like to bring to the listeners' attention this morning a name which I think we will need to be following in the near future. And I would also like to salute this young man, Yonatan Shalev. That's a name that we need to get used to. Yonatan Shalev is 23 years old. He is a military reservist activist, and he's co-founder of the movement Shoulder to Shoulder, Katef el Katef. And this is a movement that represents young reservists and young soldiers, and in particular advocates for Haredi conscription, for conscription of the ultra-Orthodox youth as well. And yesterday it was announced that Yonatan Shalev will join forces with Naftali Bennett in the upcoming election. And just to remind listeners that even though we speak mostly about the war and we speak very little about local politics, we are in an election year, and officially the election needs to take place before October of this year, according to the time that has elapsed since the last election. And Naftali Bennett has announced that Yonatan Shalev will be one of the leading candidates on a joint list that Naftali Bennett is currently constructing to allow him to stand as a prime ministerial candidate and, of course, to put his party back into the Knesset. So I salute today Yonatan Shalev, who really has stood up, has served his country with honor. He's served many hundreds of days in the reserves during this war that is still ongoing. And he has now decided to take that massive step into politics at the tender age of 23, wants to represent Israel in the political sphere. And I think it's interesting that Naftali Bennett said that when October the 7th came around, and in Naftali Bennett's view, Israel's leadership collapsed, those are the words that he used, the young generation stood up and fought. And therefore, it is very fitting that young Yonatan Shalev should come forward and represent that younger generation. I wish him a lot of good luck, and I hope that he will be immensely successful.
Absolutely. Wow, really, really incredible. Israel's Security Cabinet did not agree to a ceasefire in Lebanon at its meeting yesterday. What's happening here? What are the considerations?
Well, yesterday, during the course of the day, we had no inkling that the Security Cabinet would even consider a ceasefire in Lebanon. We heard Prime Minister Netanyahu say only the day before or a few days before that there will be no ceasefire in Lebanon. And when the Iranians insisted that a ceasefire in Lebanon should be part of the ceasefire between Iran and Israel, both Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump came forward saying Lebanon is not part of the ceasefire. Then, of course, late yesterday, word comes around that the Security Cabinet will indeed be considering a ceasefire in Lebanon, even though we are aware that there is still a lot of work to be done, that the IDF has been attempting to create a much wider buffer zone in the area of southern Lebanon to try to distance the terrorists away from the Israeli border, to give our citizens of northern Israel a slightly easier time. The last 2 days have been particularly intensive in terms of missile fire towards northern Israel. So the idea of a ceasefire late yesterday came as a little bit of a surprise to most people, and is clearly something which has been building in terms of pressure from the United States, even though the U.S. administration said yesterday that they had not requested of Israel a ceasefire with Lebanon. They did say that it would be welcome if there was a ceasefire with Lebanon. So even though they deny that they actually specifically requested it, the fact that they feel that it would be a good idea, that it would be welcome, already places pressure on Israel's government to somehow toe the line, to somehow satisfy the wishes of the US administration. But the Security Cabinet in the end last night decided not to agree to a ceasefire. And I think that that's also a significant decision in spite of the pressure that's clearly coming from the US. The ceasefire was actually not agreed. And just to put into context some other things that are going on within the US, because even though we're aware of the fact that we have a lot of good support from President Trump and his administration, it was interesting that 80% of Democratic representatives voted to stop the military cooperation with Israel. So in the United States, as well as in Europe, Israel seems to be losing support for this ongoing war. And just another very, very interesting snippet that came out from the US, because there was talk about continuing American funding for the Iron Dome system, which is clearly not an attacking system. This is a defensive system. And the reason why so many of the Democrats in particular were opposed to the idea of continuing funding for the Iron Dome is because they feel that the strength of the Iron Dome emboldens Israel to take actions elsewhere. So the fact that we've got such a solid defense system means that Israel is somehow given additional strength and additional is emboldened to somehow carry out attacks elsewhere, knowing full well that the consequences, that any retaliation that might come from those attacks would be protected by the Iron Dome. And for that reason, the American politicians, in particular from the Democratic Party, are saying they don't want to support the Iron Dome. They feel that the Iron Dome is not justified because it effectively leads Israel to carry out decisions and to carry out other military operations, which they don't agree with. And I found that a very, very interesting terminology and argument to put forward as to why they wouldn't support a defensive system which effectively has really protected many hundreds, if not thousands, of lives in Israel. There's no doubt that without the Iron Dome and all of our other anti-missile systems, Israel would be a very, very different place today after almost 3 years of war than it is right now. So all of that has kind of been thrown into the mix. Prime Minister Netanyahu in the end decided against the ceasefire in Lebanon. Mm. The war in Lebanon clearly continues unabated. And just another interesting development from yesterday is that President Trump announced that Prime Minister Netanyahu and Lebanese President Joseph Aoun are supposed to speak together sometime today. They're supposed to have a direct discussion, one with the other, sometime during the course of today, which I think is just a further interesting development in all that's going on.
You know, what's so interesting is I would argue with regard to the Iron Dome quite the opposite. I would say that if there wasn't the Iron Dome, Israel would have had no choice but to act much more aggressively in war in order to eliminate the threats around them, rather than being given the ability to pinpoint and target with accuracy the enemy. In other words, you would have seen a much more World War II-like campaign where Israel would have had no choice but to literally wipe out cities in Lebanon if it couldn't protect itself with the Iron Dome. And I would argue the same with regard to their approach, Israel's approach with Iran. So I see it as
Lebanon, Iran, and Gaza. Though Gaza, you know, there's a lot of work that's gone on in Gaza. The issue with Gaza clearly is, you know, the fact that there has been so much military infrastructure within civilian areas, which is why great swathes of Gaza have been destroyed. And by the way, the same is happening in southern Lebanon today, where IDF soldiers are just astonished at the extent of the military infrastructure that they're finding within the civilian areas in southern Lebanon. But Howard, I have a tendency to agree with you that there would be much more of a scattergun approach.
It would have to be, because you couldn't tolerate these missiles coming in and destroying places like Tel Aviv without assuming it had no defense. It would be a very different story.
And I remember very well the, for example, the Second Lebanon War, when great swathes of Nahariya and the north of Israel were destroyed because we simply didn't have the anti-missile system, and the consequences of that were substantial. People were moved away from there in large numbers, and the approach that Israel had to take was very different from the very clinical and moral approach that Israel is able to take today, because with that clinical accuracy comes a certain morality that we're able to implement into the battleground, because we are not willing to take risks in order to destroy enemies that we feel are not involved in this war, as civilian enemies who are not involved in this war. So we can afford to be a little bit more clinical. So I have a tendency to agree with you. The US politicians, however, don't. And they feel that Iron Dome emboldens Israel to do things that it otherwise wouldn't have done. And for that reason, they were opposed to the idea of funding the Iron Dome. Very, very fascinating argument indeed.
President Trump has given a strong indication that the U.S. will return to Islamabad to negotiate with Iran. Has anything changed?
Well, it was very fascinating, and I was quite amused yesterday watching the White House press briefing, where the White House press officer sort of intimated that the U.S. administration may be inclined, it was all very unspecific. And then someone asked, if the talks were to go ahead, would they be back in Islamabad? And she said, oh yes, it will definitely be in Islamabad. So it was very unspecific, but we knew exactly where it was going to take place in the event that it might take place. I think what has changed over the last week, Howard, is the blockade. And I think that this blockade has had an immense economic impact on Iran. And that may well be the reason why the Iranians are inclined to return to the negotiating table and potentially change their position. We know that President Trump has drawn a very, very firm red line, which says no nuclear development at all under any circumstances. That seems to be his red line. I just wonder whether the Iranians are willing to give that further consideration, or whether perhaps they've worked up a position which says, we will say we won't do any nuclear development, but we all know that we can do it behind the scenes. And so at least for the sake of our economy right now, and for the sake of stopping this war, let's at least pretend like we're not going to do nuclear development. I just wonder whether that might not be the position. It was interesting that the Pakistani chief of general staff, he was the one who traveled from Pakistan to Iran, was received with a red carpet when he arrived in Tehran to visit the Iranian regime. But it seems quite likely to me as if though there will be further talks in Islamabad over the coming days. President Trump denied the fact that he had requested a further 2 weeks on the ceasefire. The ceasefire, by the way, is due to expire in a week from now. So we've already had 1 week out of the 2 weeks of the ceasefire. There doesn't seem to be any meaningful progress in terms of coming to a firm agreement with Iran. But in the meantime, even during the time of this ceasefire, I think the Americans quite cleverly have applied this blockade on the Straits of Hormuz, which may well have changed the constellation, or at least changed Iran's approach to the negotiations.
And Hamas has rejected the Gaza disarmament program. I mean, we're not surprised by this.
I don't think anybody's surprised, but I think that the timing of the announcement has been brilliant from a Hamas point of view, because nobody seems to be taking notice of it. It just has flown right under the radar. They've made this announcement that they don't intend to disarm. This is something that they've indicated already for many, many months. The international community doesn't seem to be too fazed about any of that. President Trump, who laid down the rule that one of the terms of the ceasefire in Gaza is that Hamas will be disarmed, they're rejecting that. So they are somewhat emboldened, because one could argue that it would be in Hamas's interests to toe the line, to say they are going to disarm just in order to get the support that they need, and then not to disarm because they still have the tunnels and they're still operating in the tunnels. But that's not their approach. Their approach is to come right out and say, we are not disarming. And I think they feel that it doesn't necessarily negatively impact their prospects. It doesn't necessarily negatively impact the funding that they might receive in order to rebuild Gaza, the money that they might be able to get in order to rearm themselves. They're coming out and saying quite blatantly and unashamedly that they intend still to maintain their arms. Question, what do they need these arms for? What is the purpose of them being armed? And therein lies the little trick, because obviously, unless they have an intention to attack, there is no reason for Hamas to be armed. So I think they're already setting up their stall. Unfortunately, the international community doesn't quite interpret it in the same way as I do, where I say the only reason that Hamas would need their arms is to attack us, no other reason whatsoever. But of course, that little connection somehow got lost in translation.
Yep, did indeed. Anthony Reich, thank you as always. Wishing you a fantastic weekend, a Shabbat Shalom, a peaceful weekend. And we'll chat to you on Monday morning. It is 8 o'clock.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you're based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.